I am the last guy in the world that you want to fuck with.
What the fuck are you doing?
I just finished another angry letter to the Girl Scouts of America. I'm demanding year-round cookie sales.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the wonderful world of cult and exploitation, a podcast so good it just has to be fattening. I'm speaking, of course, of Junk Food Cinema here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. I'm your host, Brian Salisbury, and with me, as always, my friend and partner in crime, novelist slash screenwriter, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
And we got to do our usual housekeeping things here, so I'll remind you that Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like us on Facebook, Facebook.com/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. Well, we continue our journey through first films from prominent directors today, and this week's I'm particularly jazzed about because Michael Mann is one of my very favorite directors. I mean, you're talking about the guy that gave us Heat, The Keep, Collateral, The Insider, Last of the Mohicans, but my favorite of his films is also his first movie. So from 1981, we're going to steal a few minutes of your time talking about Thief.
James Caan. Thief.
I wear a gold watch. I wear a perfect D, flawless, 3-carat ring. I'm a thief.
One of the earliest, maybe if not the earliest, Jerry Bruckheimer production.
Very true. Very true.
You know, this is a Bruckheimer, Michael Mann film, for fuck's sake. How can you not have already seen this? You know, it is so, and it's James Caan being probably as big a fucking badass as he ever is in any movie.
Arguably even more badass than Sonny Corleone.
Yeah. Yeah. No, like he's just, this guy is interesting. He's really fucking interesting. And he has a lot in common with the character from next week's episode. But we'll talk about that next week. But yeah, no, this movie's really cool. And this is one of the two films that, as you mentioned several years ago, Nicholas Wendig Refn heavily lifted from for a little film called Drive. It was,
yeah.
And you know, everybody, you know, you had pulled these two, you know, obscure gems out, and you're like, all right, these are the two movies that when you put them together, you get Wendig's Drive and Refn's Drive. And Refn is like, no, this isn't where it came from. And you sit and you watch them, and it's like, holy shit, dude, you stole the font and practically the opening sequence from Thief,
yeah,
for your movie, and the look and the style. And then you watch Driver and you're like, he stole actual scenes from, yeah, Driver for Drive.
It's as ridiculous to me as like Quentin Tarantino claiming he had never seen City on Fire.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, you did. Like, there's no way you didn't see this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. No, cause you made it.
Yeah.
Like, beat for beat. But yeah, but the thing is why is Drive so fucking good? Because he took these two great, wonderful, obscure gems,
mm-hmm,
and put them together and then went his own way with it. And what he borrows from these movies is really great. And I feel that Refn, improved upon it, mm-hmm, and really kind of captured that tough guy machismo that has been absent from a lot of modern cinema, in that we want our protagonist to be so lovable and just so infinitely likable that we lose the tough guy asshole mystique.
Well, you lose the edge.
Yeah.
You lose the edge to those characters.
But this movie
puts all of the edge back in.
This movie's nothing but edge. This guy, the ending of this movie, there is the thing about Thief, and the thing that you will absolutely love about Thief, above its style and above its, you know, just all the cool, gritty 1981 techno thriller of isness of it, is that here you have a guy who in the first act lays out his whole philosophy. And he has this whole monologue where he says, this is who I am. This is who I had to be to survive. This is what I am. And this is what you're getting. And then the end of the movie is him proving that he was not full of shit.
Right.
That of everyone else in this movie, he's the one guy who has been a straight shooter from the get-go.
There's not a shred of nonsense in this guy. I mean, he's all business at all times and even approaches romance that way. He approaches his love life the same way he approaches his criminal career. I mean, I guess we should talk a little bit about the plot. Basically, James Caan is playing a career thief who is one of the best in the business. He's
safecracker.
He's a safecracker specifically. So he goes in, he looks for houses with the really big, with the really specialized safes, and he knows all of the tools and all of the tricks to break them, and he deals specifically most of the time in diamonds. He's looking for people who keep diamonds in safe or cash.
He is such a badass and so good at his job. His partner is Jim Belushi, and Jim Belushi knows better than to crack any fucking jokes while in this movie.
Totally.
Like,
yeah.
He just, it's like you can almost see the scene that happened, you know, before this movie started, where Jim Belushi makes one crack and fucking James Caan just smacks him upside the head and says, you're never, ever gonna fucking make a joke in front of me again. You're gonna sit there, you're gonna do your job, you're gonna take care of the electronics, and we'll crack the fucking safe. And he's like, all right, you're the boss.
I can just imagine James Caan being like, hey, you're not your brother. Sit down, shut up. And there's one moment where Jim Belushi, who plays sort of, James Caan's longtime, literally partner in crime.
Yeah, his electronics guy.
His electronics guy. There's one scene where he's walking into James Caan's house and he's just like, a tree? A pink tree? Really? A pink tree? It's like almost a joke, but he's afraid to even finish that.
Yeah.
He's like, cause pink tree. Pink, that's all I got. I don't know what, I'm so scared. I don't know what else to say. So pink tree ? Is as close as I get to a joke in this entire movie.
This is our attempt at camaraderie.
Yeah.
Like we're just so fucking serious. I'm serious all the time. And I'm so fucking scared of you because you were beaten and raped in prison and you describe it as, yeah, just some stuff happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then they some did some stuff and, but they never fucked with me again. You know, this movie goes so fucking dark in all the right places.
Yeah. And yet at the same time, it feels like it's arty, but it feels trashy enough to be so relentlessly entertaining.
Well, I think that's been the hallmark of Michael Mann's career.
Mm-hmm.
You look at his movies and they really are, like, plot wise, they are very much B movies,
mm-hmm.
but he shoots them to look like fucking A movies.
Right.
And then eventually started getting A-list stars. So they became A movies.
Right.
I mean, it really is one of those, he really does class up the joint.
He does class up the joint.
And he was one of the first guys pushing for digital film, you know, and digital filmmaking. And he was making it back with the digital camera. The HD cameras sucked.
Mm-hmm.
And like, so you have a couple movies that just as good as he makes movies look, they just don't look good because the technology wasn't there. And now we're going to see the first movie, you know, from him in what, 6 years?
Yeah. With Black Hat. Yeah.
With Black Hat. And we're going to see what he does now that digital cameras look like film. And we're going to get back to seeing films that fucking look like this.
Yeah.
Cause that's one of the hallmarks of his style is just how slick everything looks.
Yeah.
And how interested he is in camera movement.
Well, and literally how slick things look. Like, one of the tenets of a Michael Mann film is that the streets are always wet.
Yeah.
They're always wet. I mean, it's like, it's an old noir trick. It's like the days of, you know, like Blackboard Jungle and the black and white film noirs where they would make the streets wet just to give it kind of tactically, it just kind of gives this like seedier quality to everything. And they actually used a tanker truck with 60,000 gallons of water to keep the streets wet in this movie at all times.
Yeah.
So in his very first movie, he's going out of his way to utilize something that is going to become a trademark of his career. And speaking of firsts, they're firsts all through this movie. I mean, it's not just, his first directed movie. It's Jim Belushi's first movie.
Mm-hmm.
It is Dennis Farina's first movie. who plays one of the because basically what happens in the story is that James Caan
we were telling the plot.
We were, and then we got sidetracked. The plot basically, so he's so good at what he does that eventually he runs afoul of the local mob boss, played by Robert Prosky, who is an actor that if you saw you would recognize from a million things.
Yeah.
And the weirdest part is this is Robert Prosky's first movie. He didn't start acting until he was well into his 50s. And this was his first movie, and he plays sort of the local mob heavy who's like, hey, you know, you should come do jobs with me, you'll get better work. And James Caan is vehemently, like, he is the uber lone wolf.
Yeah, I am self-employed,
yes.
I run my own shit, I do my own jobs, I only do this, and I don't step on any toes. And that's the interesting thing about him is he's this guy who everybody wants to work with because he's really great at his job, and he doesn't fuck with anyone. And he doesn't run afoul of anyone, and he doesn't swing his dick around, but he won't work with anybody.
Right.
And so running afoul of the mob boss is just not working for him. And that's the thing, is that the mob boss, this guy, this crime lord, he wants this guy to come work for him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, no, I'm not going to do it. So this crime boss starts negotiating with him.
Yeah.
And he's like, what's it going to take? You know, he's like, well, I don't like lifetime employment. You know,
do a couple of jobs, and then if I want to leave, I'm done.
He's like, all right, you did two or three for me, and and I love that scene because once they start talking turkey, I mean, they're just like, you know, it's what's so interesting about this movie is that Michael Mann dives deep, and this is the early days. There wasn't really a thing called a techno thriller yet. But this is ostensibly a 1981 techno thriller that is all about getting into the minutiae of the crime world, how the crime world works from the inside, and how you go about being a safe cracker in the technical day and age. How do you break into a bank vault, you know, that's on the top of a building that has five different types of security alarms? And you don't know what the fifth one is, and you don't know how to get through this specially built safe door. And so it's all about how this guy going about his life and trying to get his life in order also tries to plot this great heist, working for what may or may not be the wrong people.
Yeah, and this is probably the most authentic. When you talk about that, when you talk about getting into the minutia, you talk about what it's really like to live in this world. I think this may be one of the most authentic crime films ever made. It's based on a book called The Home Invaders by Frank Hoheimer, who himself was a professional thief. This is what he did. So in the movie, they're using real safe cracking tools, and James Caan actually learned to do it. Like the safe at the beginning of the movie, this is a great example. Yeah. The safe at the beginning of the movie is a real safe. He's using real tools to actually break into it. There's nothing fake. There's nothing scripted about that. He's doing it.
Yeah.
Which is like, I love the whole blue collar criminal aspect. Like a guy who is just, you know, very working class criminal. And that, I think that's why James Caan fits in this role so well. It's because I've always kind of considered James Caan to be sort of the preeminent, like working class actor. He always plays characters that no matter what the station in life of the character, there's just something very organically working class about him. And I think I love the fact that not only, you know, is this based on a book by a real thief, not only are they using real tools, they actually had another professional thief come in as a consultant on the movie. And he ends up playing, his name is John Santucci, ends up playing the cop who's harassing Frank throughout the movie. And in real life, he's the guy that was actually, you know, breaking into safes. And on top of that, Dennis Farina was a former Chicago police officer. And so it's like you have real cops, real robbers in one of the great Michael Mann cops and robbers movies.
Yeah. And this is why Michael Mann cops and robbers movies are so goddamn good.
Yeah.
Because Mann gets obsessed with these details and you see it here. This is the perfect example of a first film where you really see the passion of a director come out on screen. And it's surprising to me that this film is not better known.
Yeah, that is kind of strange.
Because I guess because, you know, so many of Michael Mann's films are classic in one way, shape, or form. You know, you've got Manhunter, you've got Heat, love it or hate it, you've got Miami Vice, you've got Collateral. He's made so many great big movies that this one just kind of falls by the wayside. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with this movie. Like, there's no, this is one of those movies that it's, it qualifies for, you know, the show by nature of the fact that nobody really knows about it. That it is kind of a forgotten film.
Well, and also
as opposed to being really junky.
Well, no, but like as you mentioned, in construction, his movies are always B movies, and he elevates them.
Yeah.
So I feel like this movie qualifies on a number of levels. One of them being that he knows how to make a B movie with an artistic flair.
But this feels like an A movie.
It absolutely does.
I mean, this isn't one of those things where it's like, okay, because there's a lot of first films where you watch the first film, like with when we talked about McTiernan last week, where you watch this and you see the film school McTiernan coming out, and then you get a sense of what he's capable of, but he never goes back to doing something like that again.
Mm-hmm.
No, this is exactly what Michael Mann has done his entire career, is play at this level. Like, this is high-level Michael Mann. Like, mm-hmm. He came out and said, this is what I'm capable of. Can I do it again? And people kept letting him do it again and again. And it really works. And it really is. If you're a Michael Mann fan at all and you haven't seen Thief, Thief is one of those you need to go out and watch right away, because you're missing a giant hole of really super awesomeness. Mm-hmm. And then you'll watch it and be like, oh, dude, this totally. And so you, like, the logo comes up for Thief and you're like, it's fucking Drive's logo, except it's blue instead of pink. Like, it's and then you watch that first scene and you're like, it's so quiet. And there's this blue collar way about the working, and then where he's placing the camera in the car is like, holy shit, this inspired Drive. And then you just kind of go through, and then you get to the aspect that also Refn, you know, lifted for Drive, is just how not violent the movie is until it suddenly decides to become violent.
Well, and I think it creates the perfect juxtaposition between the world that Frank wants to live in as a criminal and the world that he knows that he'll be forced to exist in when he works for people like Robert Prosky.
Yeah.
Because at the beginning of the movie, not only is it not violent, there's a musicality. There's this weird sort of symphonic quality to how he handles cracking a safe. Like, one of my favorite shots is right at the beginning of the movie when the camera slowly travels through the hole that he's made.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, it's just this beautiful moment of perspective, and it just slides right down. And it's funny, you mentioned that it's a techno thriller. I really think that quality comes from the Tangerine Dream score more than anything else.
Well, yes and no. I mean, the Tangerine Dream score, because we hadn't mentioned that yet. Is this their first score as well?
I don't know that it's their first score.
It's really early, though. But Tangerine Dream did the score. But in terms of why I refer to it as a kind of a proto-techno thriller, is just how much time we spend and man lingers on shots of the technology they're using.
But the technology is so low. It's so lo-fi.
For us, but not at the era.
No, it is. And I will argue this, because think about even the way that they get into the final safe. Think about the final alarm that they have to crack. The final alarm that they have to crack doesn't have anything to do with computers. It doesn't have anything to do with even high-level transmitters. It's a fucking radio signal.
Well, yeah.
It's lo-fi even for its time, because they mention other types of technology, but that final alarm, we cut this wire and we have to know the code word to go out over the radio.
But it's a weird thing that they're not accustomed to, that they have to, it's one of the things they have to crack. They have to figure it out. They're like, we know there's a fifth alarm because somebody said there is, mm-hmm. but we don't know where it is. And so then they have to go and they figure it out. They figure out that it's radio. Then we see the type of technology they're using to listen in on the radio, to figure out the band they're on, mm-hmm. and to listen and record it. Then when they go to break in, you know, they cut open the telephone box, and we spend almost 2 minutes watching exactly how they're tapping in and figuring out which one is a phone line and which one's an alarm line,
yeah.
and using, you know, the electrical box, and they're getting hyper technical. The mark of a techno thriller isn't just that it is involves higher level technology. The mark of a techno thriller is that the film kind of fetishizes that technology, and we really spend time, you know, delving into it. And this movie, and that's why I said proto.
I think that's more of a logistical thing, really, than a technological thing, because I think what they're trying to get at is the just the level of care and craft. But I mean, they could be shooting that same scene with them carving wood. Like, it really does. The technology is really not the important part. The important part is how painstaking it is, and how detail oriented that they are.
I found it fascinating to watch, and just how it was, how man tells that in the shots. You're spending 2 minutes watching guys hook up alligator clips to wires, and you're fucking fascinated.
Yeah, that I absolutely agree.
And that's what really kind of made me feel, you know, just the care and how they, you know, they've got this thick safe, and so they go to, you know, a master metal worker who he's got on the sly, and he's like, figure something out. And then what they figure out is like, oh shit, well that's kind of fucking crazy.
Yeah.
And just the care of the little details that man puts into it to show just how detailed this is. Like, you know, when they go to light up the big, what I believe is magnesium bar, or whatever type.
Which is a real thing called an oxylance. Like, that actually exists. Like, that's not something they made up for the movie. Yeah. There's not an ounce of bullshit in this entire movie.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But they, you know, they go down to where, you know, it opens up on a shot in the room where he's covering the, fire extinguishers, the water valves with foam, and he's covering that up, so that when they go and light it up, they don't trip the fire alarms. Like it's like they get so detailed in a way that you only see in techno thrillers.
Yeah, and it's so, like, even the guy he talks to, the metallurgist, and I think there's a great line that he says that I think once again highlights the blue collar working class nature of James Caan's Thief, is that he's talking about, hey, we had to hire on this new fancy metallurgist, and he's wearing a white coat. Where's and they just cut a coat and goes, a white coat in this place, go figure. And it's like, yes, like that guy doesn't get it. Well, that guy doesn't understand the raw, dirty world that everybody else lives in. And you could take criminality completely out of that, and it's just like, yeah, that's a working class world right there.
And
getting your nails dirty.
And that's followed up by him with that great kind of monologue about me, you know, I've been doing this so long, you give me this thing, I'll bite it, I'll pinch it, I'll spit on it, you know, I'll roll it around in my hand, and I can tell you what it's made of. And this guy wants to say it's 1% this and 3% that, and 1%, and it's like, he's like, and he wears a white coat to work, go figure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. And this movie really highlights that blue collar nature of it. And almost kind of it's very kind of reminiscent of that 50s kind of fellaheen lifestyle, that concept of I want to do this on my own, I don't want to owe anybody anything, and I want to just go and do my own thing and not be involved with anyone else because I just don't want to be caught up with anyone else.
And it's
a really great setup for then what becomes a really fucking badass payoff, and you get something that goes very quickly to ultraviolence like Drive did. It just, once the violence kicks in, once the shotgun comes out and one guy gets gunned down, from that point on, it's just like, all right, anything goes.
Yeah. There is an animal kept in a cage inside of James Caan, and whatever you do, you do not want to let that animal out. And that's what people find out the hard way in this movie, is like, you know, what I find interesting about James Caan's character is that he speaks with clear distinction. He always wants to give the impression that he's eloquent, and, you know, he goes so far as to, he refuses to use contractions a lot of the time. Like, he has this air of eloquence, and yet the street upbringing in him, it causes him to, like, misuse words and growl about things. And so it's a very weird kind of, I don't know, like, conflict of character elements, because he's really trying to present himself as distinguished and eloquent and, you know, and learned, but then he uses words like elected. Like, he adds an extra syllable to the word elected, you know, and it's just this, it's this interesting kind of paradox where it's like, all he wants to do is prove that he's a professional, he's learned, and yet at the same time, he can't ignore the fact that he's a street kid. I mean,
and he's like that all the time, except in that monologue when he's decided he's going to be absolutely real with this girl.
Yeah.
Who he's
Tuesday been, Weld, in fact.
Tuesday Weld. He's late to their first date. She's pissed. He drags her out of the fucking bar, throws her in the goddamn car, takes her out for coffee, and then says, "You and me, we're going to happen."
Yeah.
And yeah. She's like, "No, this is not going to happen." And he goes, "Yes, and I'm going to tell you why.
So let's stop all this nonsense and get on with the big romance already." And she's just like, "What?"
Yeah.
He's like, "No, this is happening. Like, fuck all the bullshit. We're going to have this big romance."
And what? What is going on in your life that is so terrific? I'm just asking you to be with me.
And there's nothing false about him ever at any point during the movie. And you know, that scene that you're talking about takes place in a diner, because this, by the way, becomes a hallmark of Michael Mann. There's always this sort of, or a lot of times there's a big scene in a diner. And in this scene, which James Caan has remarked that this particular scene is his favorite monologue he's ever done in his entire career. You know, as Cargo mentioned, he just kind of lays it out that this is what happened to me when I was in prison. I will do anything it takes to survive. And, you know, and then he pulls out
these guys, they show up and they do some things.
And then I got this pipe from plumbing, and I knew that I couldn't take them all down, but I start swinging and I crack him over the head, and, you know, they jump on me. I spend a month in the infirmary. And then when I hit the yard, I know that I am a dead man. But you know what happens when I hit the yard? Nothing. And it's just like, oh my God, like I want to hear more stories from Frank. I want to hear more of Frank's like darkest moments, because he tells it beautifully. And
but what he does is he lays out in that speech that what he learned was, if you care about anything, if you give a shit, that it can be taken away and you can be afraid. In order to be the animal and walk the yard and deal with all these other animals, you have to not be afraid of anything. You have to not give a shit, that you know you could die at any moment, so you just don't give a shit.
Because I don't mean nothing to myself. I don't care about me. I don't care about nothing. You know, and then I know from that day that I survived, because I achieved that mental attitude.
And this is a movie about a guy who starts to give a shit, mm-hmm. who starts to collect the things to give a shit about. And then as he realizes he can lose it, he remembers who he is, mm-hmm. and he sets out to burn his whole fucking life down and take these motherfuckers out. And it is fantastic.
That really is his biggest flaw, is that he can't subscribe to his own advice.
Yeah.
Because in that moment when he's saying all this, he's also saying it to the woman that he's told that they're going to have a big romance. He's setting along the path of giving a shit.
Yeah.
And telling her he doesn't give a shit. So you know that's not going to pan out. You know that he's not going to be able to live in both of those worlds. And then he presents her with this piece of artwork that he's done, which it looks like a death row inmate's art therapy. Like, it's very, like, it's a disturbing little postcard that he's made.
Yeah, with just a little bit of young Willie Nelson.
And Willie Nelson shows up as sort of his longtime prison mentor. They have this great scene.
He's essentially his Red from
Shawshank. Yeah, yeah.
Like Willie Nelson is his as it is often called, magical Negro. He's the guy who pulls him aside and says, "Hey, let me teach you everything about prison so you can become the great man you were destined to be, you young punk."
James Caan and his magical Willie. That's really what
and his magical. Oh yes, and then something terrible happens to him, and he becomes a limp Willie.
Sad face. I want to talk about that too. Like, the intensity of James Caan as an actor, I think, is also like, there's not much of a difference, I have to believe, between Frank's personality and James Caan's actual personality. Because one of the stories that I heard about this movie that I thought was hilarious is that in that scene where the doctor comes to tell James Caan about Willie Nelson's character, James Caan just stares at him.
Yeah.
And it's like intense. Like, it's not really anger, it's just like looking through him. Yeah. And apparently the actor playing the doctor had no idea he was going to do this. So there's this look of fear and anxiety in the doctor's face that's not a performance. It's actor going, "Why is James Caan staring at me like he wants to chew my face off?
Like, did what I is fuck going up? What did I do?
Yeah.
Oh my God. James Caan is so pissed at me."
Listening for Michael Mann to yell cut, desperately hoping that the tension will end at any moment. He just walks away. It's such a...
And it works. At that moment,
oh my
great
God,
because
it's so
that
good.
Guy is so... He just seems so terrified of having just told this news. Would Would you like to sit down?
Is there anything I can do? Will you blink, please? Because you're freaking me out.
You're freaking me out here. Yeah, that scene. It's great. Yeah, no. The and Willie Nelson in his one real scene in this movie is really fucking fantastic.
He really is.
It's really good.
I mean, I hate to sound surprised by that, but I mean, he's not really an actor.
No,
you know?
He's not.
He's a musician.
Yeah.
And yeah. I want to go back for a second to the Tangerine Dream score, because I'm a big nerd for Tangerine Dream. I love it when they score movies. I like the Sorcerer soundtrack. I think is absolutely fantastic.
Oh, that's right. They did Sorcerer. So no, this is not nearly their first one.
They did, and then they also did Legend.
Well, yeah, which Legend was later,
which was famously then redone by God, I'm gonna completely blank on the name. By a composer that had been working for a long time in Hollywood, but I always prefer the Tangerine Dream score to that one.
Was it Goldsmith?
Yes, Jerry Goldsmith. That's it. But yeah, it's there's the score that they put together is, I think it walks the line of this movie really well, because it has their signature sort of dreamlike ethereal quality, but then it's also very industrial. So it finds exactly the right moments to sort of to kind of pulse and shake as if it's another drill that he would use. It's probably my favorite of their scores, and like I said, there's a lot to choose from, and I love all of them, but I think this one is probably my favorite.
It's pretty great, and it does a really interesting job in the very beginning of this movie, when we've got what is being, it's a really interesting juxtaposition, because what we're watching is a crime. We're mm-hmm. watching the commission of a crime, but we're watching it from a very technical level. We are watching, you know, as you're talking about, it's almost about the majesty of safe cracking. Like it is just gloriously shot, and it is very meticulous. It is very quiet. It is very much like the opening 5 minutes of Drive. I mm-hmm. mean, it is about the crime. It doesn't matter details, character, fuck all that. This is about a crime.
Yeah.
But in order to get that tension that we are, you know, at any moment we could be busted, that's where Tangerine Dream comes in. And Tangerine Dream adds this very kind of tense, fast, vibrant music to these otherwise clinical scenes, creating this interesting juxtaposition, but giving you a real feeling of both what it is to be a professional criminal, but still have that tension that mm-hmm. the police could come out at any moment and fuck your shit up. Yeah. And it's really elegantly done. And that score there works so well.
Yeah, I absolutely love it. And, you know, when you start to piss off James Caan in any movie, and especially in this one, you know that what you're moving toward is a final siege, a final taking of names and kicking of asses, and that is exactly the final act of this movie. And that final siege is the pinnacle of who Frank is, because there's not even typical movie nonsense in the way that he goes about that final siege. Because in any other movie, the way that would work is that he would take out all the peons first and then work his way up to the A number one, the
Duke. He doesn't
care
about the peons.
No, he fucking goes for that guy first and takes him out.
Almost.
And then takes everyone else out on the way out of the house.
Yeah, everybody else is running up because they're like, no, this is our job, despite the fact that we've totally failed.
Totally failed!
And then James Caan just like, all right, I gotta kill all of you.
When he says in this movie, I am the last guy in the world that you want to fuck with, he's absolutely right. And there are a lot of people in this movie that find that out the hard way in that final siege.
Oh, yeah.
And it's so amazing. And there are people, folks die horribly in like bloody gymnastics shot with, you know, high speed photography that actually would also become kind of a staple of Michael Mann films later on, is that, you know, people get shot and there's just like this glorious, like gritty slow motion to it even. But it's, again, like the fact that he takes out the boss first and works his way down is just so backwards from, you know, normal crime films. That's not the way it's supposed to work.
And there's,
but because this character is so no-nonsense, he's like, fuck those guys. I know what I'm here for. I'm getting it done.
It's interesting because, you know, to talk about, like, the wet works at the end of the movie, there's one particular scene where one of the characters gets gunned down in a well-lit room. And you can tell that it's that old, terrible red paint blood.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's the, you're watching it and you're like, oh, it's the red paint blood, which just doesn't actually look like blood at all. And then, you know, and for the first two shots, it's like, okay, it's that. But I can forgive it because it's so well shot. And then they have a squib that goes, and just creates this beautiful fucking blood pattern on the wall that's just so fucking cinematic. And the way the final death scene works, you're just like, holy shit, like, I don't care about the red paint blood anymore because that is so goddamn cinematic.
Yeah.
And it's gorgeous just the way it's executed. And I don't think I've ever seen a squib create quite that pattern before. You'll see, when you watch it, you'll see what I'm talking about. It's just kind of like, it's like, oh, wow, that is kind of fucking cool.
Yeah.
And yeah, so it's, and that siege is really something else. I mean, it's, he goes through the very technical aspects of how he gets into this house and how he lays the siege,
yeah,
and how it goes in the exact same way he's been treating everything else. And, you know, in most movies, it would just be, you know, we'd be inside the villain's house and there's our hero.
Mm-hmm.
And this time it's like, no, we're going to show how he gets in a screen door, how he gets in the front door,
yeah,
how he creeps around and, you know, and just everything. And it fetishizes it all. And it's really fantastically done.
Yeah. And I want to talk for a second. I mean, we've done this on in our previous episode. We're going to kind of make this a signature of the series. It's to talk about the director DNA. And we've already talked about it a little bit, but I want to talk about how this movie could be viewed as a warm-up act for Heat, because there's so much in this movie that would be repeated in Heat. I mean, we already talked a little bit about the cops and robbers, and we talked a little bit about, you know, blue-collar criminals and sort of the working-class nature of the safecracker played by James Caan that is mirrored a little bit in Robert De Niro's character in Heat, because there is a sort of like, this is what I do, no nonsense, it's a business. You know, you have to, it's like a list. It's like he's running down a list, an itinerary in his head, like, you do this, and then you do this, and you do, like, every move is calculated. And there is nothing, I mean, and that's what's so great about the last robbery in Heat, is when everything is going wrong, who is able to keep their cool and abide by that code and stick to the list, and who isn't. And that's really what causes all the chaos, of the people that stray from that list, stray from the itinerary. But there's, like, even the line, you know, even the whole speech about, you get to a point where nothing means nothing and you don't give a fuck about anything. You think about that line put up next to what De Niro says about, you don't take anything that you can't walk away from in 5 minutes flat if you feel the heat coming around the corner. It's a very similar philosophy. It's like, you can't care about anything because you have to be prepared to walk away. And not only does James Caan's character walk away, he burns down his entire life.
Yeah.
He throws his wife out. He's just like, we're done. Get out. This is over. And it's mostly for her protection. But then, like, he destroys his house. He burns his business down. He even blows up the place where he used to drink. Like, he...
No, that was his bar.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But, I mean, he leaves no trail that he ever existed on this planet.
Yeah. And it's the prelude to that, though, is that great scene with Prosky. Where he's just like, you think you have power because you ain't afraid of nothing, because you're not afraid to die, you know. Well, that's not how it works. Here's what I'm gonna do, and he starts listing down the litany of things he's gonna do to fuck this guy over, and that he's gonna lose everything. And so, just to prove a goddamn point, he burns it all down.
Yeah,
and
you can't take away from me what I already took away from myself.
Yeah, no, it's like, that's not who I am. And
it's the most extreme, you can't fire me, I quit, that I've ever seen.
But that's the thing, is he burns down his whole life, and then he goes and he burns down this guy's life.
Yeah.
You know, and he just starts taking these guys out. And it's like, you guys have something to fear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't.
And that last shot is so perfect.
Oh, yeah.
That last shot is just, okay, done, walk away, end of movie.
Yeah.
Like, that's it. Like, he accomplished exactly what he wanted to do. No muss, no fuss, no frills, no thrills, just gone.
And again, the ending of Drive,
yes,
which is he appears to be mortally wounded, But does he live or does he die? I don't know. That's up to you, because that's not the point of the fucking movie.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And then, of course, there are other elements. I like man's creative use of light sources. Like, you know, you were mentioning before about some of the camera angles that he chooses. There's one shot at the beginning where the moon is shining through this like spider web of fire escapes, like between these two buildings. And it's just this really, like, it looked like a painting. It was so expertly crafted, and the moon as the only light source at that time, and then you kind of pan down and then you get to the lights that are on the lower street below, is just, it's gorgeous. It's just like we said, he takes B movie material and he approaches it like an A movie, and he elevates the art form, and that's exactly what he does with the light sources that he uses.
Well, I mean, that's why the streets are always wet. It's not just because it gives it like a murky, you know, kind of a...
But it reflects gritty, light off, yeah.
It reflects light back up,
right,
in a way that creates a really interesting... I mean, that's another one of Mann's signature things. In fact, it was Mann's use of light that inspired one of the kills in Sinister. You know, I don't often talk about, you know, what we did with Sinister, but we went to Manhunter on that with the scene in the house where you see the camera shooting a flashlight going up the stairs and going room to room. Is we used Manhunter as a reference for that, and from when we wrote it to when they shot it, it was, you know, they sat, you know, this Scott sat the cinematographer down, Chris Knorr, who by the way is doing Gotham right now. So if you look Gotham and go, wow, this show looks really good, it's because Chris Knorr's doing it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it sat Chris Knorr down and said, we're going to watch Manhunter. This is how we're going to shoot it. And it was just like, bing, we get that. Yeah, because the man then uses light in all of his films in really interesting ways. And I think that's why he was so fascinated with HD, mm-hmm. was because it captured light in new and different ways. Like, you know, you watch Collateral and you watch Miami Vice, and that's one of the first times you really see kind of the halogen orange look, mm-hmm. of the city captured in film, because, you know, up until this point, when we're shooting films at night, it still looks like the old white street lights and like incandescent light. And Mann wanted to catch it in that orange, weird grittiness, and does so magnificently to where it feels so raw and real that was one of the disconnect people had with them.
Yeah, I always make the joke that Michael Mann films have only two settings, daytime and 2 a.m. Like, if it's night, it's that weird, everything's closed, it's very desolate. Like, it just, even in the busiest cities, at, you know, just past the sun going down, it always feels like 2 a.m. And I think it has to do with the way, you know, his use of light. I think it has to do with him trying to create this very isolationist kind of depiction of even a big city, to create that juxtaposition. And I think he does it magnificently well. And I want to say one more thing about his sort of using blue collar criminals. And I think that comes from Mann's personal experience, because he was amongst his odd jobs before becoming a director, he was a short order cook. He worked construction jobs, and he worked as a cab driver. Like, this is a guy that has had those jobs, and he said he's always found, I think the quote is, a tremendous richness in real life experience and contact with people and circumstances that were sometimes extreme. Like, it's just kind of his personal mantra. And I think that's what bleeds over into his work and gives us characters like Frank, gives us characters like Neil from Heat, played by Robert De Niro. And I think that's a really beautiful thing when a director can bring a lot of that personal experience and that feeling into the films. And to come out of the gates with an established style is not, I mean, sometimes we have
a style that he still has today.
That is so, you know, identifying and idiosyncratic, and yet at the same time he's maintained throughout his entire career, when sometimes we watch his first films and we kind of have to sift through it a little bit to find the seeds of that style. This is just, it's there. It's established.
Yeah. Like, next week we're going to be talking about that again, because the next week's movie doesn't look like the director's other films at all.
At all.
But everything about the story is this, but this is so clearly everything about this movie is a fucking Michael Mann movie. Like there is, and as we said at the beginning, not a weak Michael Mann movie, not a learning Michael Mann movie. It's like this guy popped out of film school and the womb fully formed, ready to shoot his movies his way, and he nailed it. And that's why he's one of the best.
Yeah, and that's certainly why he's one of my favorite directors. I mean, with Thief, with Manhunter, with The Keep, I mean, I feel like this guy came out swinging in a way that we don't always see. Even from great directors, sometimes it's like great movie, and then, you know, maybe a miss, and then it's like, but it's like, man, came out swinging, and came out swinging big time. And yeah, I mean, I feel like he's had some missteps of late.
Yeah.
But I feel like early on in his career, you'd be like, in the first five or six films, like, you'd kind of be hard pressed to find a misstep. Like, he really swung for the fences and did it tremendously well.
Well, but I think early on, he wasn't as successful that in retrospect, when you go back and look at the films, they're really great. But
I mean, they were great regardless. Success, yeah. I mean, we can talk all day about the factors that influence the success of a movie, but I think they were always great.
Yes.
You know,
no, I agree.
I think the level of appreciation will probably change, you know, like as a lot of art, you know, sometimes isn't appreciated when it is first released or first hits the scene, but there was always that greatness in man. And like I said, it's just so remarkable to see a style established so immediately. And I mean, just a couple other notes about the authenticity of a Michael Mann film. So the house explosion at the end of the movie, what they did is they actually built a structure in front of a real house, and they were just going to blow up the kind of the facade that they'd made. Problem is, they used way too much explosive and ended up not only destroying the house behind the structure they had built, but the two houses on either side. Oh, no. And had to basically, like, compensate the people who live there. And then, you know, there's the other thing about, like, there's just little moments like James Caan's lighter not working in the diner. Like, that wasn't scripted. That was completely just something they left in there. And even the story that he tells in the diner is based on a letter that Michael Mann got from a real inmate. So I think that's why just all throughout the film, there's never an iota of bullshit. Everything feels real.
Well, and in terms of DNA, I mean, that's very much Heat as well. Heat is based on a real
robbery in LA. Yeah.
Yeah. And that they used the cops as technical advisors. And every once in a while, like on Reddit, I'll see people talking about Heat or talking about the video of that crime and how they have a hard time separating the two in their head because they're so close.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting how detailed Mann gets about a lot of the stuff. And I think that's why Manhunter works so well. And I think that's why why Thief works so well, and why so many of his movies do, you know, do work so unbelievably well in making you feel like these are the perfect crime movies. In the same way, you know, Scorsese is so nuanced about showing, you know, making us like terrible and interested in terrible characters, and that he shows us that angle of crime. Mann loves showing us the technical aspect of it, and here's how they fucking work, and showing that it's a job.
Yeah.
Like that's the interesting thing about it. Like
expect him to punch in before he breaks into a safe.
Yeah, like
a punch card.
It really is the, you know, it's watching how much work goes into this fucking thing. Like, it is not this glorified, hey, you know, this Ocean's 11 boom, but the boom boom,
yeah,
boom boom. Everything's happy, but don't boom boom. No, it's like, yeah, no, I got to go into this greasy pit of a metalworking place to talk to this guy to find this thing, you know, and I got to go and I got to make sure I get my phone calls that are made from phone booths to my fucking bar, to the phone on the bar. Watching him take apart his phone at home to show the bug to his wife.
Yeah.
Like, just, he just fetishizes every little bit of this in such a fantastic, interesting way. It's just, it's so mesmerizing. And then on top of that, it has all these great characters and really great drama.
Yeah.
And an interesting structure, because the way the film is structured is just, is just so fascinating, and like we said before, was lifted heavily by Refn.
Yeah, and again, if you're a fan of Heat, this is something you really need to track down. I mean, Criterion put out a great Blu-ray of this movie, and one of the things you'll notice is that, like, James Caan even pulls the same transponder on the bus switcheroo that Neil does in Heat. And if you listen to the commentary, the original commentary for Thief, Michael Mann talks about this movie that he's shooting with Pacino and De Niro as they're talking about Thief. And it's like, oh, he's talking about Heat. So as he's like looking at his own work, he's like, yeah, I'm working on this other film. And the thing he doesn't say is that I'm borrowing from my own movie Thief heavily for. But it's absolutely a fantastic crime film. My favorite Michael Mann film. And the fact that it's his very first film and it's my favorite and he's had a career of such great movies, I think it is a real accomplishment. And yeah, bravo all the way around.
It ends, it's over.
So now it's time, of course, for the junk food pairing, and you might have to stick with me a little bit on this one, but we're going to go with Wimpy Burgers. Much like Wimpy, the lovable burger-loving tramp from the Popeye cartoons, Leo, played by Robert Prosky, tried to tell Frank that he would gladly pay him Tuesday for a job he pulled today, and that backfired in his face. In all seriousness, though, this one line of dialogue where Robert Prosky tells... he tells James Caan that people will be eating your family for lunch in their Wimpy Burgers tomorrow.
I'll grind them up and have them put in the Wimpy Burgers,
yeah.
And no one will
and
know.
And no one will know. This one line of dialogue, this seemingly thrown away product placement, actually ties into the odd release history of this movie. Because when it was originally in theaters, the line was McDonald's hamburgers. And then when it hit VHS, they took the word McDonald's out, so it was just hamburgers. And then when it hit DVD and Blu-ray, it was Wimpy Burgers. So they have like an entirely third take that is, you know, for a restaurant that by the time the DVD and Blu-ray came out, you might be able to find a Wimpy Burger in like Podunk, West Virginia somewhere, if you're lucky, next to the Hojo and the Stuckey's. And it's just, it's really interesting to me that, you know, we talk about, you know, like you said, just kind of this greasy feel and this, you know, very working class. And I don't know of a more working class character than this tramp in the Popeyes cartoons who could never afford to eat a hamburger. And I think it's hilarious that it changed, like the line kept changing. And as it got, as the film aged, the reference got more obscure. Like, you would think it would work the other way around, where it would start at Wimpy Burger, which would have been more popular at the time the movie was released, and then work its way up to McDonald's, but it's the complete opposite. And, yeah, I feel that the older this movie gets, the better it ages and the more there is to appreciate about it. So I'm going with Wimpy Burgers.
All right. And and you should eat them in your James Caan bear suit.
Yes. James Caan bear suit.
There are so many moments in this film where James Caan is walking around only wearing pants and a bear suit. Like, it's, he's got this fur coating that is the type
it's
of thing you
all
just don't
natural bear, that
you
bear
just,
suit.
You just don't see in Hollywood films anymore. Like, if you've got a fur chest, like, you never ever reveal it, or you get that shit waxed before you have to take your shirt off in a movie. Because so it really is kind of one of those relics of the times where, hey, we're selling James Caan as a furry sex symbol. And it's like, yeah, only in 1981 and before then could you get away with that. And it's, so Wimpy Burgers in your bear suit.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. Hope you've enjoyed, this walk down the memory lane of wet streets and gritty criminals. Want to remind you yet again that Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also find us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, or you can like the website on Facebook, the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
Find me at facebook.com/massaworm. That's MASSAWYRM. And at massaworm on twitter.com.
You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. You can also find me on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. And please do check out my home away from home, oneofus.net. Lots of great geek podcasts and geek blogs. This has been great. And next week, I don't really want to tell you what we're doing. But as Cargill mentioned, it's not going to be as easy to pick out the director DNA next week, because it just doesn't... There's not much there that feels distinctly like this particular director, although I know he's one of my personal favorite directors, and I think I can speak for Cargill that he's one of both of our favorite directors.
Yeah. And this is probably one of my favorite movies that we've talked about in the past year, because we're not digging up one of our deep fried favorites. Neither of us had watched this. We watched it for this series because we went and revisited a bunch of films, and we were just blown away that this was a film that hadn't been on our radar, that we knew it existed, but we'd never really heard anything about it, so it wasn't on the list. And next week we're going to put it on the list for you because you need to see this fucking movie.
All right, and until next week, remember, be a straight arrow, be a true blue kind of a guy, be the last guy in the world that anybody wants to fuck with.